Welcome to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. I want to thank you for joining us today on the show as we continue our coverage on how the COVID-19 global pandemic is affecting the continent. This week, the world hit another unfortunate milestone as the number of infections surpassed 5 million people. In Africa, the rate of infection is still low compared to the rest of the world. Confirmed cases are around 120,000, with the number of deaths a little over 3,400. But like we said in our previous show, these figures continue to change on a daily basis as more people get tested, and in some cases, as more countries relax social distancing rules. And that's why the WHO is cautioning African countries to stay vigilant as they begin to ease their lockdown restrictions. They warn that health systems in many of these countries are in no way prepared for an upsurge in infections. But far beyond its immediate health impact, the pandemic continues to affect economies across the continent. It also continues to have an impact on young people, especially those whose education was cut short when schools were closed over a month and a half ago. In Malawi, elementary school children normally get meals at school. But when the coronavirus pandemic forced schools to close in March, families were left with the added cost burden. And as Lamek Masina reports, the international charity Mary's Meals, which runs the feeding program in one-third of Malawi's elementary schools, has started distributing food to poor communities to help them cope.
Mary's Meals has been feeding thousands of children in the schools for the past 18 years. The young learners receive wheat porridge made from maize or soybean flour mixed with salt and sugar. The aim is to increase enrollment for children who might fail to attend classes because of hunger in their families and to meet the nutrition needs of the students. Bert Rombert is the country director for Mary's Meals in Malawi. He spoke to VOA by telephone.
We normally work in around 1,000 under 6 in primary schools in Malawi, and we have a focus on some special schools, children who are suffering from HIV/AIDS, and also disabled children. So those children received special attention, let's say in total about 940, so approximately 1 million children in Malawi are covered by this action.
The closure of schools in March because of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, deprived students of this source of nutrition, posing a threat to their health. Lizdet Kanamule says her two children are benefiting from the school feeding program. She told VOA via telephone that although the meals are meant for her children, the whole family is benefiting. She says this is helping us a lot, and because of this pandemic, things are not working. We are facing food shortages in our homes. So as a family, the foodstuffs we are receiving for our children are helping us because we are cooking porridge to cater for the whole family. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, as social distancing restrictions around the continent begin easing in cities like Kampala, Nairobi, Kigali, and others, many people are speaking to us about some of the impact that the COVID-19 lockdowns have had on their lives. Let's listen.
My name is Bantu Drek. I'm a businessman, ideally in secondhand clothes. I've got a bar. Then professionally, I play for Kigezi FC in a regional league. I do football. Businesses are not going on well. Ever since lockdown started, bars were closed. We are not getting any good of secondhand clothes because they are not allowed in the country.
David Isabire is my name. I'm a journalist working with Uganda's online sports website, www.kawo.com. Ever since the 17th of March 2020, my work as an online sports journalist has been severely hampered. I have not been able to move from home to office. Since the sporting activities were banned, I've been not able to cover the sports events like I used to do.
Those were some of your voices, people speaking to us about how the COVID-19 lockdown has affected their lives and continues to affect their lives. Now, the East African region has been an interesting study on how the various leadership has responded to COVID-19. You see, countries like Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda instituted lockdown restrictions early on in the pandemic. However, Tanzania, a key member of the East African bloc, did not enforce similar restrictions. Its leadership took a position that this was not as serious as it was being made out to be. In fact, President Magufuli remains a little skeptical about various aspects of this pandemic, to the extent that some people are being punished when they raise concerns about the pandemic. And this has led to a strain in the relationship of these East African trading partners. And that's because the numbers are saying something different. The Economist recently reported that over 50 Tanzanian truck drivers tested positive for the coronavirus after crossing into neighboring Kenya. Many other truck drivers from Tanzania are testing positive as they get these tests at border posts with Burundi, with Uganda and others. So the question many people are asking is the government of Tanzania not being open about the scale of the pandemic? That, among many, are some of the issues that we discuss with Kenyan writer and political analyst Nanjala Nyabola. Nanjala is the author of the book Digital Democracy, Analog Politics, How the Internet Era is Transforming Politics in Kenya. She's also the author of the forthcoming book Traveling While Black, Essays Inspired by a Life of Travel. Nanjala gives us a picture of what is happening on the continent, starting off in Nairobi.
Everything in Nairobi right now is very uncertain. There's a lot of flux and there's a lot of really rapidly changing variables. Since the first cases were reported in Nairobi, in Kenya really in March, the numbers have just constantly gone up. So there's not been even a week where we can say, well, at least the numbers have gone down. The numbers keep going up. The numbers of fatalities are going up as well, but not as quickly as feared, as initially feared. But we are getting a couple of fatalities. The really big hit has been in the measures that have been taken to slow down the outbreak. So as you know, Nairobi is currently under it's a strange kind of lockdown in that we are not allowed to leave or enter the city from different parts of the country. And we have a curfew that starts at 7 p.m. and at 5:30 a.m. But between 5:30 a.m. and 7 p.m., life is just kind of going on.
Right.
So
if you live in Nairobi, you're not allowed to leave the city parameter?
No. Nairobi and Mombasa, so the two major cities, there's no entry or exit. And that's partly because in the beginning, there were people who, you know, Nairobi is a transit point for the rest of the country. You have a lot of tourists, for example, who come to Kenya to go to Mombasa, to go to the game parks, and they pass through Nairobi. You have a lot of, if you're coming from abroad, Kenyan returning residents, most of the first cases, that's what they were. They would come to Nairobi, transit, go somewhere else. So we had a lot of cases that were taken to a lot of really remote places. One of the first affected places was Mandera on the border with Ethiopia and Somalia. And that's a place that has, you know, very poor infrastructure. It takes 2 days to drive there. So if they have an outbreak, it can actually be a really big disaster. So part of the reason, the justification the government has given is that they want to stop people from circulating, from taking the disease elsewhere.
Do you feel at this point in your assessment that the government has a handle on the situation?
No. Yeah.
We'll get back to that later, but I wanted to talk about, you know, broadly what is happening on the continent. For the past 2 months, we've been in the news cycle has been dominated by, you know, COVID-related stories, which is understandable. We're in a global pandemic. But what are some of the things that we might be missing on the continent that we should be paying attention to? Things like either important elections that we might not have given as much attention as necessary.
Well, I mean, the Burundi election is obviously a great example of something like that. And the connection between politics and the pandemic, the transition is being some journalists are already labeling the transition democratic, but, you know, Burundians will question that when journalists were arrested in the weeks leading up to the elections. Human rights activists went missing in the weeks leading up to the election. So can you really call it democratic if the environment in which the election was being conducted was one of intimidation and misinformation, really? Another big story that was on the horizon, two big elections that were on the horizon that have been moved indeterminately, are the Ethiopia election and the Cote d'Ivoire election. So the Ethiopian election was supposed to happen in August, and there's supposed to be a census and then an election. It would have been the first census in I think, 20 years. But it's certainly the first election, the first somewhat representative election since the end, since this transition between, which is looking less and less like a transition and more of a shape-shifting. So just, there's a lot of transition in Ethiopia right now that is getting subsumed under the broader anxiety of COVID. There's still a lot of political uncertainty that needs to be resolved. Cote d'Ivoire is another one. Mm. You know, Cote d'Ivoire, it's coming up to 2010, yeah, 10 years since the end of the civil war in Cote d'Ivoire. And it looked for a long time like Alassane Ouattara was not going to cede power, but he's assured the public that he would, and he's selected a candidate, so that's good. But it's a test, you know. I think Cote d'Ivoire also is another country that had a long period of one-party rule, had a long period of authoritarian rule, and then sort of went into civil war. And so it's a real test for the democracy in that country. Mm. But then the question is, will we have an election in October?
Right. There's been talk that one of the reasons why Africa's infection rate has been low is the continent does not have the capacity to test enough people. And then the more you test, the more numbers reveal themselves. What is your sense on this? What do you attribute the continent's low COVID numbers to?
I think that's an overly simplistic analysis that it doesn't really connect to how statistics work. Mm. And how a lot of things work. So I know that people, first of all, there's no country in the world that is doing 100% testing. Even South Korea, which is doing testing at an incredible scale, is not getting to 100%. Mm. So the idea that African countries not testing comprehensively is somehow, you know, qualitatively different from what's happening in the UK, from what's happening in the US, is unfair. I think what's more interesting, you know, and people who work with statistics will tell you that you could have a number and your interpretation of that number is going to be different depending on what your interests or what you're looking for, right?
Right.
What your model was,
right.
So what we're looking for with the COVID numbers is not absolute infection rates. We're looking for trends. We're looking for, are the numbers trending upwards? Are they trending downwards? Are we getting more fatalities? Are we getting less fatalities? We're not just looking at the numbers and saying, because the government told us 6 people died today and 7 people died tomorrow, then Africa has a low infection rate. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the fact that it took 3 days for Kenya to get from 6 to 30, and it took 1 day for Tanzania to get from 6 to 30. That tells you that it's spreading much more in Tanzania than it is spreading in Kenya. But the absolute numbers in themselves are not meaningful because it's nearly impossible to get to that level of testing.
Right. So testing is not what we should be looking at.
It's not, the numbers aren't saying the thing that people want them to be saying. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if you, I do a lot of work on tech and politics, and I look at internet penetration rates, and I look at the use of social media. I could tell you that there are 100,000 Kenyans who are on Twitter in 2015, and that number, you look at it and say, well, that's nothing. There are 8 million Twitter users in Kenya, so that 100,000 means nothing. But if I tell you that there were 100,000 Twitter users in Kenya in 2016, and there were 1 million Kenyan Twitter users in 2017, in 1 year, there's been a tenfold increase in Twitter usage in Kenya. That number is telling you something. It's the same numbers, but the story is different because right. You're looking at different places. That's what we need to be doing with these COVID-19 numbers. We're interested in trends. We're interested in the rates of mortality. So from the 50 people that we've tested, if 6 or 7 are dying, today and tomorrow 10, 11, 12 are dying, there's something that we're not doing to give help to people who need it the most. That's how we should interpret these COVID-19 numbers, I think. Not the absolute, the absolute numbers are almost referentially meaningless, meaning right. that they just, it's a broad indicator, but it's not giving you anything specific that you can look
at. Yeah, so if you were to look at trends in East Africa, just staying in East Africa, what do they tell you about the COVID story in East Africa?
The first thing that I look at, for example, in Kenya, is the deliberate decision by the government to test at a lower capacity that it has. So we have the Kenya Medical Research Institute, which is the main public body that's leading the testing regimen. So we have private and public testing. KEMRI is doing the public testing mostly. And they're telling us that they have a capacity to test 6,000 samples a day, but the government is announcing that they're testing 2,000, 3,000 samples a day. And on a good day, in fact, on most days, it's 1,000. When I look at those numbers, then I have questions. Why is the government not testing to its full capacity? And that leads you to another story about the global market for reagents and how African countries are getting squeezed in this global market for testing reagents mm-hmm. and how we are being outbid, outpriced, outflanked by Western countries. And any notion of a global approach, global response to this disease is meaningless if the most vulnerable countries are being edged out
right.
of the testing just on practical grounds.
Right. They don't have the buying, they don't have the buying power to compete.
They don't have the buying power to compete. Yeah. So it tells me that you're this vocalized commitment to equality and sharing and inclusiveness in managing this disease, that commitment is hollow. Mm-hmm. When I look comparatively, I look at the countries like Tanzania where the numbers are going up. I look at the national policies on COVID-19, and that tells us that there's a government that's in denial about the extent of the outbreak. I look at people who give, when government representatives give numbers that the government doesn't like, they lose their jobs. That is a political story that tells you about an outbreak. And especially, I look at the number of Tanzanian truckers crossing the Kenya-Tanzania border and testing positive in Kenya. That suggests an outbreak in Tanzania that is a little bit more out of control than the government is alluding to.
Which is probably that untold story we talked about earlier, some of the things that are happening.
Yeah, exactly. I look at the same thing with countries like Burundi and Burundi truckers going into Tanzania and Tanzania sending Burundian truckers back. And I look at Uganda sending Kenyan truckers back. It suggests that there's a low level of community spread that's going undetected. Mm. Those are the numbers that are interesting, that even if it's not in absolute terms, it suggests that there's something that's going on that's not being captured. But there is another metric that is interesting to me that I would love for journalists to dig deeper into. When I look at the symptoms and the way in which COVID-19 has behaved in other countries, you expect that if there is a significant level of community spread, that there will be an uptick in hospital admissions for people with respiratory illnesses, for people who are, or even people who are dying in their homes of respiratory, unexplained respiratory conditions. We're not really seeing that in Kenya, for example. Or if it's happening, no one's really looking into it or measuring it. And suddenly the government's not announcing it. That, I think, is going to be the strong indicator of the community spread. That we're seeing hospitals, for example, in South Africa, public hospitals getting overrun by, you know, people coming in, even if they don't know that it's COVID-19 right. when they go in, showing up with the symptoms, showing up with respiratory distress, because respiratory illnesses should be happening, should be incidence of respiratory
should
illnesses
be on the rise.
Should be on the rise, even if we don't know that it's COVID-19. The other statistic that's interesting to my monitor in Africa is what's happening to our doctors and our nurses. Yesterday, the Kenyan government announced that 38 medics had tested positive for COVID-19. What's happened in other countries, again, is that hospitals have become petri dishes for this disease, that it is doctors and nurses who are seeing asymptomatic patients who are being exposed.
Right, the frontline workers, basically.
Frontline workers. Mm. What's going to happen? A couple of years ago, it's changed considerably since then, but I think about 10 years ago, there were more Kenyan doctors working in the NHS than they were working in the Kenyan public health system. If you have a couple of hundred Kenyan doctors and 10, 20, 30% of the medical workforce in the public health system is taken down by this disease, what's going to happen to the public health systems? And keep in mind, in East Africa, Kenya has I think Tanzania spends more on public health because Tanzania has a bigger population. But, you know, we're talking about Kenya has 518 ICU beds with ventilator capacity for a population of 47 million. And those 518 beds, they're not empty. Many of them are already occupied, people who have other illnesses, accident victims and things like that. So another interesting metric to watch is going to be how are the doctors and the nurses doing?
Right.
I think those kinds of metrics, we should stop aspiring to 100% testing. It's not going to happen. It's not happening anywhere. Let's watch the incidental statistics, the things that will point to what's happening at the community, and stopping things before they get out of control.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bunganyi. Now, Botswana's strict COVID-19 border checks have riled truck drivers who say that they spend days waiting to be cleared. Botswana has so far confirmed only 35 COVID-19 cases and one death, but began requiring the border testing amid rising concerns about imported infections. Mkondisi Dube reports from Habarone.
Truck drivers are growing frustrated with long delays at Botswana's borders due to required COVID-19 testing. The truckers say they wait for up to 5 days before being cleared to deliver goods in Botswana or transit through the country. Zambian truck driver Amon Piri complains there are no washing facilities at the border checkpost and they run out of food while waiting for results.
We are frustrated with the situation going on. We've been kept in Botswana since we crossed from Zambia for about 5 days now. No results. And we are all truck drivers gathered in one place, about 100 trucks. And we are being kept here with a single toilet. No water, no food. We are only using the bush as a core of nature.
Piri urged Botswana authorities to speed up the testing. South African truck driver Malusi Dlamini says the delays have led to tensions across the border in South Africa. He says some South African truckers are threatening to block trucks entering from Botswana if the situation is not resolved.
It's a frustrating situation. We hope that it will be addressed soon before tensions boil over. There are long queues of up to 10 kilometers of trucks waiting to be cleared.
Botswana truck drivers are also subjected to COVID-19 tests when they re-enter the country. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. Now, as many African countries instituted lockdown measures early on in the pandemic, measures were met with resistance among the population. For many people, it took long to sink in that they were being told to abandon every aspect of their economic and social life. And so many resisted. But instead of the governments looking for better ways to communicate with the population, they resorted to enforcement methods, some of which were condemned by the United Nations as flouting the rule of law in the name of fighting the coronavirus pandemic. Nanjala explains.
I've been trying to explain some of the imagery, the videos, the photos of police and other security agencies, whether it was in Kenya or in Uganda, where in the first days or the first weeks of the lockdowns, police engaging in either running battles with the citizens, in some cases, brutally assaulting them. How do you explain the tension in this relationship between the residents and the security agencies in this country?
I think one of my favorite quotes ever is, when all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. I think a lot of African governments have a history of disproportionately spending on security and securitization and not spending on anything else. And so whenever a problem arises, it always looks like a security problem, and therefore the call is to send the police. And I think this is a historical practice that is embedded in the way in which post-colonialism or the failures of decolonization in a lot of African countries, because this is what colonialism did. It turned Black people especially into security threats that must be managed through elaborate legislative policing, violent systems. Like the point of colonialism was not the well-being of Black people. It's not so that, you know, Black Africans can thrive. It was Black bodies are labor. Labor must be made efficient. And the police and policing the most out of labor. This logic of socio-political organization has never really been fully interrogated in a lot of post-colonial states. A lot of governments still look out on the landscape of their countries, their societies, and see Black people, just Black as they are, as labor, as resources, as a point of extraction, not as human beings whose lives, goals, joys, hopes, dreams have to be actualized. And so what happened when a public health crisis comes, you can't police your way out of a public health crisis. You can't beat your way out of a public health crisis. You have to activate all of these other things that we're talking about, these community health mechanisms, these outreach programs and things like that. But these, it's like a muscle, you're asking a lot of governments to use muscles that they've never had to use. You're asking people who have only sought power for the sake of power, for the sake of being powerful, never for the next thing, which is, well, what are you going to do with this power once you have it? Mm-hmm. Who is going to benefit from the power once you have it? How are you going to wield your power in a way that is for the greater good? And I loop this back to what I said before about how did these governments that we have in East Africa at the moment, how did they get to power? What was their path to power? Was it open, transparent, fair? Or was it compromised? Was it through elections that were being conducted under a shroud of violence, intimidation, corruption, all of that stuff? So to me, what we saw, and we're still seeing it, maybe the images are not as visceral as they were in the beginning, but there's still this low level of criminalization of a public health response and the consequences that flow from that. You know, in Kenya, for example, as I said, they said that if you were caught breaking curfew, you would be put into mandatory quarantine for 14 days. But the quarantine was supposed to be undertaken at your own expense. And their estimated cost minimum was 28,000 shillings or $280 in a country where the minimum wage is a dollar a day, or the regular wage that people make in the city is about a dollar a day. How many days would you have to work? You literally have to work for half a year to be able to pay off that quarantine debt. What happened? People stopped getting tested. The government came out and said, we've identified these hotspots. We want you to test, please come out. And they got 28 people to come out and get tested in a hotspot because nobody wanted to get arrested.
Right.
These are the challenges that are compounded. You drive people underground. And again, we don't have to go back in history. This is exactly what happened with HIV/AIDS. After the period of disbelief, after the period of this is witchcraft, this is things that are coming from abroad, when people realize that this is a thing that was happening locally, you know, the criminalization of the response to HIV/AIDS drives people underground. People don't want to get tested. People don't want to know what their status is. People don't want to interact with formal health systems because they think, well, I just don't want to deal with the consequences of that.
Right. Which becomes harder for the government to get a clear picture of what exactly is happening.
You'll never know. Mm. You'll never know what's happening at the community level because the community is lying to you. Mm. You've given them a false choice between their health and their security. And especially when they're saying that most people are asymptomatic, the people who are transmitting the most are asymptomatic. Mm. They'll just think, well, as long as I don't know, then it's not a problem.
Right.
You know, and that's the paradox that you said. These are the things that the securitization of public health, we really, really have to walk back from. Mm. We've created a problem. We've set off on the wrong foot.
Thank you, Nanjala. And with that, we come to the end of our show. I want to thank our guest, Nanjala Nyabola. Nanjala joined me from Nairobi, Kenya. Until next time, goodbye, Africa. Yeah.